My name is Beth Manuel, and I'd like to introduce Tamara Weaver, who represents the Common Ground Committee of the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice, and she organized this program tonight. So welcome, and Tamara, it's up to you. Thanks.
Hi. Salam alaikum. Okay. This event is organized by the Common Ground Committee of the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice, ICPJ, and I'm a member of the Common Ground Committee. The idea for this event happened when we had the main speaker, Heather Laird. She was in our general meeting and spoke shortly, like for 5 minutes, about this subject, and we were so interested in it, we asked her until she said, okay, she will give us a whole event. Heather organized the very impressive panel that you have here. You read their names. And she will introduce each one of them when they speak. I will introduce Heather now. She's our main speaker and organizer with me. Heather Laird. She has her BA from Indiana University, Bloomington, in political science and Arab science and Arabic and Islamic studies. She has her MPA with a non-profit management concentration and public management certificate from Eastern Michigan University. She is the director for the Summer Arabic Institute and a fellow of the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding, ISPU. She has her own consulting group, Laird and Associate. She also writes for the religious and spirituality section of examiner.com. Last moment news, Heather just became a board member of the ICPJ, of our organization. Okay, now, Heather.
Thank you, Tamar. Assalamu alaikum. I greet you with the universal greetings of all Muslims. It means, sure. Peace and blessings to all of you. We are really blessed as a Muslim community to have such a very diverse population, diverse meaning the attributes that set us apart from one another, as well as a vast variation in cultural backgrounds. Although we are not monolithic in our thinking, we are diverse. One of the many ways that we are diverse is in thought. We have, as you may have heard in different venues, we have Sunnis, we have Shia, we have Sufis, and we have others. And even within those groups, we have different schools of thought. As well, and our population is very diverse. Their largest population in the United States are African American Muslims. The next largest are Indian and Pakistani Muslims. And then we have Arab Muslims, Caucasian Muslims, Southeast Asian Muslims, and so on. What's interesting, though, is that as a community, internationally, we're able to be bound together as sisters and brothers because we share a commonality in belief. And that commonality binds us so much so that if, and I've seen this before traveling around, if I'm in Cairo walking down the street and it happens to be time for prayer, and I start making prayer, somebody may come up beside me and start making prayer with me, be a total stranger. But because we share those common values and beliefs, it's as if there's a relationship that exists without knowing one another personally. This allows us to really work through issues of adversity and differences by always coming back to that commonality. It's a good starting point, and it's even in our revelation that God created us in many tribes so that we may know one another. As a community, we promote multicultural sensitivities and outreach in many different ways, and I wanted to share with you some of those techniques that we use, that have been used. First, though, I would like to explain what a mosque is in Islam. A mosque is where we go to attend Friday prayer. And a mosque is meant for worship and reflection. There are some in southeastern Michigan that welcome people from all backgrounds, and there are others that are more aligned toward ethnic cultural background. However, it's interesting, a friend of mine who also happens to be an Islamic scholar and a professor in Cambridge, England, recently spoke in Toronto and mentioned that his mosque in Cambridge is one where people, even non-Muslims, come to reflect because they have taken great lengths to make the mosque one without signifiers that would unwelcome others. And in doing so, they have created this very spiritual environment where people who are not Muslim come there as well. It has expanded so much so that they are now in the process of building a new mosque. So one of the ways in which they try to, this is one example of trying to bring everyone together by avoiding, you know, having those signifiers in their mosque that would make others feel like, oh, I don't really believe quite like that, so I don't want to come here. That was a really interesting. And then another technique that the Prophet Muhammad himself, salatu wasalam, taught us was called brothering. And in this concept, he paired people to become brothers of different tribes, so much so that they needed to know like what the other person needed before they asked for it. And by the time that they finished, by the time this has sort of saturated the community, there were people upon their brother's death were talking about inheritance rights. So they really truly became brothers and sisters and knew one another and accepted each other's differences and became, you know, one community. Others have encouraged intercultural marriages, of which there are now many. There are also many interracial and intercultural relationships in the American Muslim landscape. And unlike in the broader community, they seem to be a lot more accepted. And in more specific incidents, like the recent incident we had here in Ann Arbor with the young lady whose hijab was removed on the bus, we attempted to build bridges through many different methods. First, there were emails flying around trying to figure out as a community how could we address this issue. There were some people who went directly to speak to members of the Ann Arbor school. Others of us got together with some of our younger members of the community, for example, the Muslim Student Association of Ann Arbor at U of M. We thought that they would be good mentors for the young high school people, and this would be a good way to develop relationships, because what we found was when we looked deeper into the situation in Ann Arbor, this was a long-standing issue. It wasn't just an issue between those two individuals. There had been a long-standing issue between African-American children and Arab children in the Ann Arbor Public Schools. And it didn't seem to matter whether you went to Huron or Pioneer or, you know, it was indiscriminate. So a bunch of us got together at a cafe, representatives of different various student organizations on campus, the MSA, Black Student Union, many different groups, and we had at that time a guest speaker from Chicago who came in from the IMAN, the Inner City Muslim Action Network, because they've had a lot of experience working in this vein, and we got lots of advice. And what we found was, instead of going on with the mentoring, we needed to take a step back, because what the students were very honest to say to us was that some of them had not had the interactions growing up with other cultures to feel comfortable to do that. So I remember one young lady, for example, intimated to us that her parents had always taken her down to Detroit to do the soup kitchens, but that had left her with the impression that blacks were all poor. So, you know, what that did then is, you know, we went back, and so we just started learning these lessons, and we took baby steps to address it by having more interaction first between the Muslim Student Association and the Black Student Union, and now they're reaching out and doing all kinds of things on campus together, as well as reaching out to other offices on campus that give them the tools they need to further this along. So it was a really good learning process, but what was nice about it is because we have this value and commonality, we were able to discuss these things. Another issue that came up recently was a film where we had a Muslim organization in California that wanted to give an award to a film from Bollywood that was, you know, from maybe an Indian perspective, a nice reflection of things that people had gone through in India. But there were some scenes in it that depicted, from an African-American perspective, antebellum racism. And so we had, within the Muslim community, black leadership writing letters about these scenes in the movie, and then immigrant population writing letters back about their perspective. And what, you know, I was actually consulted about this from both sides, and because I'm a part of neither one of those groups, and I could see they both had real important points. Something that I didn't know but I learned was that for some people that were from India who had, there's in this movie there's a marriage between a Hindu woman and a Muslim man. Normally in Islam this is not permissible, although it has been allowable by some scholars. I think mainly for the purposes it has created some unifying things in our community, but what had transpired in India was many people during the riots were killed, their families were killed. So this film was very meaningful to people who had that experience in their families. But for African Americans and being a part of the American landscape, to see scenes that depict what we have been trying to get rid of in the United States for so long, it was just, it was like too much, because even black actors now, I just watched a documentary recently on black actors who are trying to rid the acting community of black exploitation films. They said the time for that has come and gone, and there's so many other characters one can play that there's no need for that anymore. So they're now working to find a solution to this together. Thank you. Some of the greatest tension that we experience comes from a lack of knowing one another. And hopefully through some of the examples I've gave, we're trying to make those bridges happen and get to know each other better. When people don't know one another, then they're often operating on limited information. And we see this also problematic in the broader community outside the Muslim community, because we've seen the Muslim community demonized through the media and marginalized by the government. And that has created tension between the Muslim community and others. Part of that has made people feel very cut off, but there are others who have participated in interfaith activities as well as opportunities like this. And I think that one great thing that we could do as a large community, Muslim and non-Muslim, is to offer safe spaces like this for us to come together and share our stories and concerns about one another, so that we can, you know, find our own common ground as a broader community. And hopefully tonight, some of these stories, you will maybe hear something new or learn something that you will find commonality in yourselves. We have four phenomenal women here who are going to speak on their experiences as Muslims, as well as some of the work they've done around multicultural issues. So are we ready to start? Okay, so I'd first like to introduce to you Sister Baina K. Muhammad. She has spent most of her life teaching in both public and private Islamic schools or as a private tutor. Ms. Muhammad holds a master's in teaching and learning technologies, which guides her work in the Center for Adaptive Technology, a computer lab supporting the needs of EMU's disabled students. Baina recently completed a Master's of Fine Arts in theater, during which she wrote and directed the performance Unveiled, Stories from the Lives of Muslim Women. She is also the author of a children's book, If Everyone Were Just Like Me, which, by the way, we have copies of here if anyone is interested in afterwards. Ms. Muhammad is hoping that her 6 children and 5 grandchildren can survive without her as she embarks on a 2-year adventure teaching 3rd grade in Abu Dhabi beginning this August. Please welcome Sister Baina.
Peace and blessings to you all this evening. I thank Sister Heather for inviting me to be part of this conversation, and I commend the Interfaith Council and the library for continued efforts to mesh the different color threads that form the beautiful tapestry of our Ann Arbor community. Race was a constant focus of attention when I was growing up in the 50s, even in New York City. In 1955, Rosa Parks was marched off to jail for keeping her seat on a Montgomery bus, an act which officially began the civil rights movement. It's significant in that I feel my youth was a continuous search for validation and admittance. My conversion to Islam was as much an attempt at finding a community of people to which I could belong as it was an attempt to find spiritual fulfillment. I grew up in a lower middle class household in a newly built high rise in Harlem with two professional parents, a housekeeper, and upright Wurlitzer piano and Saturday dance lessons. When I attended the local public school, also attended by children who lived down the street in tenements and homes headed by welfare moms, I was a pariah. I remember being beaten up, shunned by peers of my own race because I was thought to be a stuck-up rich kid. So where did I belong? By eighth grade, I was in the Dalton School, frequently mentioned on the TV show Gossip Girl, as an elite private school on Manhattan's Upper East Side, where my family's Ford station wagon was upstaged by the chauffeured limos that brought my classmates to school. My Wurlitzer was dwarfed by baby grands housed in living rooms larger than my entire apartment. At Dalton, I was no longer the stuck-up rich kid. I became the token black scholarship kid. My parents were teachers, but my schoolmates' parents were doctors, lawyers, David Susskind, the talk show host, Richard Avedon, the world-famous photographer, and Betty Friedan, nicknamed the mother of the feminist movement. So where did I belong? I learned to look to God for acceptance early in life. We attended the small storefront Methodist church where my grandfather was the minister, but I was on a journey to locate a truth I felt was missing there. I began my sampling of other Christian denominations and alternate faiths as early as age 10, and it was in Islam that I found inspiration and a truth that resonated in my heart and soul. It may have been even Malcolm X himself that I heard preaching the message of black unity, independence. The black man should educate himself and stop blaming the white man for his condition, is what I heard from the soapbox orator as I walked home from my piano lesson one afternoon. But when I got home and looked up Elijah Muhammad, the prophet of the Nation of Islam I had just heard being preached about, I could only find Muhammad from Mecca in the World Book Encyclopedia. And it was the story of his prophethood and the spread of Islam around the globe that enveloped my heart. I was confused about the two men called Muhammad, but joined the Nation of Islam at age 17, since that was the only Islamic community I was aware of. Besides, the men and the women in the nation were quite visible in the community, sweeping ghetto streets, giving out food to the poor, selling newspapers, fish, bean pies, door to door, and preaching a consistent message of hope for black people. Quite naturally, tens of thousands of people became followers. And the story of that movement and its impact on Islam is a story that will be told probably at another time. In the 1980s, though, I was recruited as a teacher for the madrasa in the tiny town where Georgia O'Keeffe painted Abiquiu, New Mexico. There, I met my first white American and European converts. I experienced the total opposite end of the spectrum from the black nationalist community I'd moved from. In New Mexico, I saw the University of Islam, maybe just as Malcolm had seen it when he visited the holy city of Mecca and was joined by millions of Muslims from every continent in the world making Hajj. The Abiquiu Muslims were mostly Sufis who played flutes, ouds, chanted enthusiastically the names of Allah, wore Birkenstocks or wooden Dutch shoes, and taught me to drink Earl Grey with cardamom. I was formerly strictly a celestial seasonings gal before that. When I arrived in Abiquiu with my husband and four children, the entire community, all of about a dozen families, had turned out to greet the new teacher. An adorable, little red-haired and abundantly freckled spokesperson greeted me shyly with, "Assalamu alaikum, Auntie Bayina." We were served succulent baked rabbit, freshly killed that day by the hostess, with greens from her garden, saffron rice, and her extraordinary peach cobbler. This was a place I could belong. Here in heaven among the Sufis, I felt at peace, lulled by the flow of the Chama River, surrounded by the Meccan-like desert environment, happy with the easy pace of spiritual life in the land of enchantment. 13 years and 2 children later, after the madrasa closed for lack of continued support from a Saudi princess, I relocated to Michigan. The Sufi group I had come to love has a retreat in Fenton, Michigan, so U-Haul packed, kids in tow, we made the trek to Canton, Michigan in 1995, where I joined the staff of Crescent Academy International. In Michigan, I met an even more diverse representation of Muslims, Middle Easterners from various countries, West Africans, Somalians, Southeast Asians. And it is here in Michigan that I truly found myself. Here I synthesized my love for education, my passion for the arts, and social activism. My previous experiences in the communities where I belonged were founded on separatism, a black nation of Muslims separate from mainstream America, practicing their own flavor of Islam, next to Sufi group and nestled on top of a scenic mesa, but away, separate. Within the religion of Islam, I had found a place at last where I belonged, but my personal evolution, I felt, wasn't complete. So this portion of my life is designed to intersect with a larger American community. As the fifth grade teacher at the Muslim school in Canton, we invited a fifth grade class from a neighboring public school just after the New York bombing. We played some drama games, shared lunch, and paired off students, and partners created a quilt shared of their common vision for a future world, a simple statement of peace and understanding. Later, the finished quilt was displayed for several weeks in each of the schools. In 2002, I stopped teaching, feeling strongly that I needed to get involved with teaching the Western world about Islam. I was constantly annoyed by the media stereotypes of Muslim women, portrayed as vamps or victims, terrorists or turncoats. I set out to write a play that would truly represent us, but I had no idea how to write a play, and the result was awful. So I enrolled in a master's program in theater to learn my craft, and on September 11th, 2006, as one of my theater projects, my piece unveiled, Stories from the Lives of Women, Muslim Women, debuted at Eastern Michigan University. A combined audience of nearly 400 people, including EMU faculty, students, and Muslims from metro area communities, gave the performance a standing ovation. And one of the deans insisted we repeat the performance during Women's History Month, saying that the entire university needed exposure to Islam at this level. The show will be produced again in June if any of you would like us to come to your venue to perform, speak from the after. I also wrote a children's book, If Everyone Were Just Like Me, to show readers that all children are basically the same. They have disagreements with older siblings, want to be able to go out and ride their brand new bikes, need love, and pout when they're not the best at everything. I wanted to illustrate, too, that Arabs aren't the only Muslims by featuring 4 children from different parts of the Islamic world in my story. As an adult Muslim, I found out that racial prejudice exists within the Muslim community. Even though our religion bonds us, as Sister Heather says, socioeconomics and certain cultural traditions prevent some ethnicities within our community from creating alliances, which is sad to me because the African-American Muslims have developed strategies from decades of racial profiling in America that could serve as guides in overcoming the same type of profiling and outright hatred being displayed today among the general Muslim population. So, it's also my hope that the Muslim readers of my book will come away with a greater acceptance of Muslims from all cultural backgrounds. The obvious benefit of the book is that the Muslim children will see positive images of themselves, which I attempted to do in the book and with the performance piece unveiled. One Syrian lady, after seeing the play, cried to me saying, "You never see anything good about us. Never. Wallahi, Sister Baina, this is beautiful." Some of you may know who that was, by the way. Judging from the response I got from unveiled performances and from numerous events like this one, there is a sincere effort towards interfaith understanding and inclusion of Muslims in conversation about Islam. Interaction is necessary, I believe, to patch the growing rift between cultures based on media misinformation and, in my opinion, fueled by world leaders to whom war is advantageous. The interactions that we have need to be as strategically planned and implemented as the negative seeds have been. My campaign will be waged through the arts. I envision an Islamic cultural renaissance sweeping through North America led by American Muslims who are in the unique position to bridge both worlds. It is through poetry, song, and shared stories that ideas and information permeate the masses. It is through the arts that hearts in a society are reached. Muslims need to become a more visible part of the American landscape and be active, contributing members in the country that is our home. This is where I belong. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister Baina.
Thank you.
Thank you, Baina. Our next speaker is Sister Samaya Flower. She has been the elementary school principal of Crescent Academy International for the past 10 years. She has 25 years of experience in the field of Islamic education, both as a teacher and an administrator. She was educated at New York University and Jersey City State University. She has a master's degree in school administration and curriculum and a bachelor's degree in elementary education. Sister Samaya currently serves on the board of the Islamic Schools League of America. She is the founding member of the Islamic Education Foundation of New Jersey and Razi School in Queens, New York. Alhamdulillah, all of her four children have attended and graduated from Islamic schools. Please welcome Sister Samaya.
Assalamu alaikum. Good afternoon. Is this working well? Okay, good. I'm usually tempted to take it out of here, but people get annoyed, especially the sound people, if you do that. Okay, this is my path to Islam in 10 minutes or less. So it won't be my complete life story. It'll be more of the beginnings of things. My parents and most of my family members are Jewish, and they view themselves as secular Jews, meaning being Jewish is their ethnic and cultural identity more than a religious identity to them. But the only person in my family who was really sure she believed in God was my grandmother. I also had a neighbor who was a best friend who was a Baptist, who wanted to save my soul from hellfire when we were about 12 years old. And she made a very serious effort to do that. When we were both about 25, I thanked her for loving me enough to think that that was important. I went to Hebrew school and Sunday school because I wanted a bas mitzvah, a big party that you have when you turn 13, coming of age. In the Reform temple that my parents went to, it was becoming popular for girls to have a bas mitzvah, although it was still not as big a deal as it was for the boys. I grew up on Long Island in the 1970s, and if you remember the liberal 70s, it was all about breaking the rules, if there were any. And my parents never explicitly set any, thinking my brother and I somehow had enough common sense to know the limits. Maybe he did, but I didn't. From the time I was 11 or 12, I was really searching for some meaning in life. I kept asking the question, is this all there is? Getting good grades, trying to be like the popular kids, dressing well, striving for a Barbie doll figure. Is this all there is to life? I once asked my mother this question, and I added, because if this is it, I don't think I want to live. She asked me if I was serious or just trying to get a reaction. I told her I was kidding. But that was a lie. After high school, I went to Israel for 9 months. And when I came back, I tried to rediscover my roots. If I start the story of Israel, that will take at least another hour in itself. So that's for another time and place. But when I came back, I did have the sense that, you know, I should really try to figure out who I am as a Jew. I was living in New York City at the time, and I decided to look into conservative Judaism instead of the Reform temple that I had grown up in. And what I found was Judaism seemed to me to be more about the history of the Jewish people than about God. That's how it was portrayed to me most of my life. And what I wanted to know was, who is God? Does he exist? And do I have a relationship with him? I tried transcendental meditation, much to my parents' dismay, and found peace in that for moments at a time, but not enough to sustain a meaningful and happy life. I attended New York University, and I hung out in Washington Square Park. One day, while listening to an impromptu concert there, an African-American man handed me a joint and asked, "Do you believe in God?" I looked into his deep brown eyes and answered truthfully, "I don't know. Nobody has asked me that question for a long time. I'll have to think about it." Thank you. The question planted a seed, and I did think. The man's name was Abdullah, and he hung out in that park all the time. So I started going there in between classes and asking him questions. Like, "How do you know there is a God?" He had good answers. And when he ran out of those, he told me to go to the masjid and get a Quran, which I did. And one day I asked God to prove his existence to me. And he started to do just that. The universe became an open book of his signs. The perfect petals of a flower and the newly photographed rings around Saturn became proof of a designer's existence. Allah tells us in the Quran that he will show us the signs in the universe and within ourselves until we believe. So I had started to believe, but I needed more. So I asked Abdullah about loneliness and being alone, because there's a lot of that in New York City apartments, and even in life, right? Even if you do have a roommate or a family. There's a certain void in the heart that only God can fill. Abdullah was a very smart man, and he really knew how to talk to me. He told me that there was a hotline number, 33, 33, 34, and that you could call on that number whenever you wanted. And so he told me this formula, okay? We have something called tasbih, or dhikr, remembrance of Allah. And it's customary to say 33 times, glory to God, 33 times, all praises to God, and 34 times, God is great. It's subhanallah, alhamdulillah, Allahu Akbar. So I started calling that number, that hotline number, 33, 33, 34, several times a day, and I realized that God was actually with me. So that void was starting to get filled. Of course, there are many teachers on one's spiritual path. And my next mentors were Muslim students at New York University. It was 1979. Some people remember that year. The Americans had been taken hostage by Iranian students at the American Embassy in Tehran. Remember how you felt about that? I, like most Americans, were flabbergasted and outraged that such a thing could have happened. You know, who were these people? Who did they think they were? So when I walked by the Muslim Students Association table during those student activities days at the beginning of the school year, I stopped by the MSA table and I said, to the Iranian students that were standing there, "How dare you take our people hostage? Who do you think you are? Your politics stink. But tell me about your religion." And the guy at the table smiled graciously and said, "What would you like to know?" I had many questions, and over the next few weeks, my friends did their best to answer them. They impressed me in many ways. One of the most significant was the way they treated me, an attractive, stylish, single American college girl. They didn't flirt. They didn't come on to me in any way. They were respectful in a way that American men just were not. I found this strange, but refreshing and non-threatening. They introduced me to some female Muslim students, and I began to learn about hijab and haya, covering and modesty. And I realized that their respectful behavior had to do with the standard of modesty required of men and women in Islam. Most of you might, you know, you might look at hijab as a sign of oppression, but in reality, it is a sign of liberation and freedom. It frees you from being appraised for the shape of your body and the color and style of your hair. Hijab demands that somebody look at your face and listen to your words instead of running their eyes up and down your body as you speak. Hijab protects women and society from the exploitation of physical beauty. And when I walked down the street in Manhattan in my short business suit, I got catcalls. When my body was mostly covered, modestly, I didn't. And I liked that. It's very simple. So I began to consider committing myself to God as a Muslim. The word Muslim means one who submits to God's will above his or her own. And I started to pray. I put on hijab, I took my shahada, and began my journey toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that's a lifelong journey. As Allah tells us in the Quran, chapter 81, verse 19, you will journey on from stage to stage. And in another chapter, regarding the soul's journey, he tells us that the person is successful who purifies their soul, and the person who's unsuccessful is the one who lets it stagnate, no growth. So the goal is always to learn, to grow, and to change. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Sister Samaya. Our next speaker, Sister Shireen Khan, is both a lawyer and entrepreneur. She practices law and estate planning and contracts. She also runs the operations of I Learned Online, LLC, an online tutoring company for grades K through 12. Shireen is a happily married woman with three daughters. She's also an alumni of U of M. Please welcome Sister Shireen.
Good evening, everyone. Growing up Muslim in Michigan, I felt very lucky. On the weekends, my family would take me to our mosque and community center where we would go for social events. There would always be activities going on for families and kids. It was a great place to go to just be with people of our faith and just, you know, be in a safe environment with them. But so on the weekends, we had our Muslim community, and in the weekdays, of course, we attended public school. And I had my friends that were not of the Muslim faith. And in order to spend time with them, I wanted a sense of belonging with them as well. And so I joined Girl Scouts. I'm sure all of you know about Girl Scouts. It was great because, you know, we did activities, we earned badges, we went camping, sang songs, and I ate the s'mores without the marshmallows because we don't eat gelatin. But it was nice to, you know, have this interaction with my friends outside of my Muslim community. And and I remember once when we were at a camping event, my friend and I, we had to make one of our five daily prayers. And so in the evening, in our cabin, we started, you know, to make our prayer. And we didn't notice, but our whole troop had come and formed a circle around us. And when we finished, they all clapped for us. And we were surprised. We didn't know what was going on. And they were just impressed by what we were doing and that, you know, we followed our faith so religiously. And it made us feel proud that we had something that we could share with them that was unique and different and something that they wanted to learn about. So going, growing up in middle school and high school, I didn't do Girl Scouts, but I participated in cross country and track. But I always had my Muslim community on the weekends, and then I would, have my clubs and other activities I would do at school. So our Muslim community was always a base for us, but we participated in society as well. And so after going to college, I met my husband here at the University of Michigan. We have three daughters, and two of them attend Crescent Academy, where Sister Samay is a principal. And since I have three girls, I thought that I should get started with Girl Scouts with them. So last year, we started a Girl Scouts troop. And some of you may know the Girl Scouts law. On my honor, I will try to serve God and my country, to help others at all times, and to live by the Girl Scout law. This is something that's so American and so Muslim at the same time. So this is what we teach our girls and Girl Scouts, that you can be a good American citizen and a good Muslim at the same time, and there's no difference between the two. So as part of Girl Scouts, some of the badges that we covered were being honest and fair. We depicted this badge last year by splitting the girls into groups and doing skits on different scenarios. If someone's cheating in school or asking you for answers on a test, what would you do? If someone's, if you take something from a store and you didn't realize, what would you do? Would you take it back to the store and pay for it? And we talked about being fair and playing sports, not cheating when you're playing pin the tail on the donkey, things like that. Things that are, just values that are so important as Muslims and Americans. Other badges we worked on are making the world a better place. So we took bags and garbage bags and went around the school and collected, just cleaned up the area. And we emphasized the importance of being, nice and clean and keeping your neighborhoods nice and clean. And this is good for us as Americans and us as Muslims. And then also just being considerate and caring. We collected money for local families in Canton, Michigan that, that didn't have enough money for winter clothing. So these are just all values that are important as Muslims and Americans as well. This is what we emphasize to the girls. So you would think that having a group of Muslims at the Crescent Academy in Canton, Michigan, you would think that we would all be a homogenous group. But in actuality, we're very diverse. We have blacks, whites, Indian, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Arabs, Malaysians. So we cover a huge spectrum, not only in our background, but also in our socioeconomic background, and then also in our thought within Islam. Some people are more on the strict side, and some people are more on the liberal side. So this kind of came out when once we had an activity we wanted to do on fitness and showing the girls that it was important to be healthy and stay fit. And we wanted to, the organizers, we decided to do a little event and we wanted to do Bali Fit, which is, if you haven't heard of it, it's a new trend, which is like incorporating Bollywood dancing with fitness aspects. And so we didn't really think anything of it when we were, suggesting the activity, but several parents came back to us and said, do you really think this is a good idea? I don't think we should be dancing or teaching the girls this because this isn't allowed in Islam. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we had people that said, no, it's a good activity. We need to encourage fitness, and, fitness through dance is a great way to, expose the girls to this, and within certain parameters, it's okay in Islam. So this kind of started a dialogue within our email group about what's allowed and what's not allowed in Islam. And just basically, it came about that we, some critical thinking skills when it comes to Islam and what you can do and what you can't do. And, although there were differences of opinion, we respected everyone's opinion within this group. And we decided to come to a compromise where we did an American line dance. So we incorporated a little bit of fitness. And we did it to Jai Ho, which is the theme song for Slumdog Millionaire. The girls had a great time. And there was one family that decided to keep their kids home that day, which we said was fine. And we had given them an alternate activity to do. Heather's actually a co-leader with me at the Girl Scouts troop. So in the end, we all came together and we had, although we had differences of opinion, we were able to express our views and, go on with the activity in a way that was agreeable to everyone. So basically, as you can see, Girl Scouts is kind of a microcosm of the intersection of Islam in America. And although we come from different backgrounds and cultures, we share a faith that we have integrated with life in America.
If I could just add, Sister Shireen's a very brave Girl Scout leader because we have 40 girls in our one troop. This comes after years of, this was a long process actually to start the Girl Scouts because there was some distrust of what is Girl Scouts at first, and now, as you can see, we have so much interest, we need more leaders. I just want to take the opportunity right now to just let you know, if you don't know already, there should be cards on everyone's chairs. And these are for to write questions if you have questions. We will have a question and answer period after our next speaker. So if you have any and you want to start thinking about that, or I just want to let you know that they're there. Grace will collect them later. Okay, so our next speaker, Sister Mona, is currently an attorney in private practice but has spent time in the public sector working for the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office and the Michigan Attorney General's Office. Her focus in both offices was on family issues, mainly abuse and neglect of children. She has 3 children, and she is a graduate of the University of Michigan here in Ann Arbor. Please welcome Sister Mona.
Thank you and good evening. My name is Mona Youssef, and by way of background, unlike the first 3 speakers, I was born and raised Muslim my whole life. I was born to both parents from Egypt. They immigrated here back in the 70s, and I was born in 79, so you can figure out how old I am. So my whole life I grew up in a home where I saw my parents praying. We ate food that was halal, kosher for Muslims, I guess. But I lived in a community where there were not very many Muslims close by. I went to public school. I played sports at school and outside of school. And it wasn't until the early 90s when we moved from New Jersey to Michigan, to Canton, Michigan, where I had a large Muslim community around me. I went to high school at Plymouth-Salem. And at that time, although right now there's a huge Muslim population there and there's a Muslim Student Association, at that school there was a handful of Muslims. And we did pray Jummah Friday together at school. And that was about it at school. I was married young by choice. I met my husband at the local mosque. We didn't have a relationship going on for too long, but my husband proposed the summer after my senior year of high school, and I thought about it, and I knew him because I saw him at the mosque all the time, and we planned activities together for our local youth group, and I prayed to God to guide me in making the right decision, and I felt very, very comfortable getting married to him. We both had older siblings that were not yet married, but we went ahead and we got married at the ages of 19 and 20. And we were engaged for a year before that. My husband was not of Arab background. He was of Indian background. So there were some differences. There's different clothing and different expectations, a lot of cultural things around the actual marriage ceremony. But there were some issues. We worked our way through them, and both of our families get along very well, which is really good for us. And, I love wearing the Indian clothes, and when my husband wants Indian food, we go over to his mother. Because I think it's the hardest kind of cooking that there is. I did go to U of M for undergrad and for law school. And throughout my life, there's been a theme that my parents have instilled in us of generosity and public service. And I went into law not with the expectation of, you know, having a great practice that brings in a lot of money, but with I had an expectation and a goal of serving my greater community. There were not very many lawyers, Muslim lawyers, that I knew of when I started law school, and not very many that I knew of when I graduated. I decided that I was going to go into government work. I feel strongly that any government, whether it be local or state or federal, no matter what sector of government it is, should be representative of its of the population that it serves. So with that in mind, I had worked in the federal courts for some time as an intern. I interned at the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, and I went on to become an assistant attorney general. I worked in the Child Abuse and Neglect Unit down in Wayne County. And for those of you who are familiar with that unit or with the child abuse and neglect cases that go on in Wayne County, it's quite unbelievable. What you see on TV as far as child abuse and neglect goes doesn't compare to what really goes on. And the types of abuse cases that I've dealt with are still on my mind. I represented the state in these proceedings, so I represented CPS, Child Protective Services, and foster care workers, and any Department of Human Service individual who appeared in those cases. And our, you know, although we represented that entity, what we were striving for in the end was whatever was in the best interest of the child. And I didn't have any conflict with my religious beliefs and the law. I didn't have any, they actually went so well together, so I never felt conflicted. I'm a strong believer in the American justice system. I think it's probably the best in the world. And I, as a Muslim lawyer, I never feel conflicted about, you know, promoting the law or abiding by the law and my religious beliefs at the same time. You know, when I saw the topic for this presentation, the thought that kept coming to my mind about, you know, what is it like for me being Muslim in America, I kept thinking, well, you know what, I feel like I'm such an ordinary person. The issues I face are probably the same issues that my neighbor faces, you know, work-life balance and, you know, worrying about my kids and, you know, who they're playing with and how they're, you know, gonna grow up to be, you know, time management, that's always an issue for me. Getting my kids to school on time and their principals just sitting two seats down. So, you know, it's a huge challenge for me every morning. And that's, you know, both my husband and I work, we actually work together now in private practice. And, you know, keeping our lawn up, you know, up to par with the neighbors, that's a big issue. Dealing with my children's sibling rivalry, I've got three children now. In many ways, I can relate to Everyone Loves Raymond because I feel like my parents live down the street and my husband's parents live about 10 minutes away. And they're always coming over and, you know, we love them, but we've got, I mean, I feel so American and I feel so ordinary. So that was something that I really wanted to emphasize today. I am Muslim and in some ways being Muslim shapes every hour of my day, but it really doesn't make me that much different from my neighbors.
Thank you. So if we could once again thank these four phenomenal women for speaking today. It was really nice what they had to share. And as you notice, from four different perspectives as well, I don't know if you caught this, but Sister Baina and Sister Samaya and I are all three converts, and Sister Sharina and Sister Mona grew up Muslim in America. So hopefully that gave you a nice sense of the diversity that we have in our community. Do we have any questions? Okay.
This morning they were late.
I don't notice any. I don't look. I've given up on all that.
Okay, here's a general question for anyone who wants to answer it, or if you all want to answer it. Can you please address wearing a hijab on a job interview? How about wearing hijab in public? I guess it would be more like how to wear it. Is that the question? Or?
Is it hard, I guess?
How do employers respond to you when you come in? Do they ever react negatively?
I'll take it. I think sometimes they do. And I think it depends on where you're interviewing and perhaps the type of job that you're interviewing for. I had never felt discriminated against, ever, until I was applying for jobs as a lawyer. And I think that although I was public service oriented and I really wanted to do government, I also applied for some positions in private law firms. And I felt that especially at those law firms, which, you know, the bigger ones are usually run by Caucasian males, at least traditionally they have been, and I did feel discriminated against. But you deal with it. I mean, what are you going to do? I think 10 years from now, when hijab is, people are more used to it, I think that's not going to be so much an issue. In our private practice right now, we have clients ranging from corporations that are run by, you know, older white males who, you know, they use our firm because we're good. And, you know, we have clients that are Muslim who want something done in a Muslim-specific way, usually estate planning. They want done in an Islamically compliant way. But I think, I mean, yeah, sometimes you face discrimination and you can either cry about it or you can just sort of move on. And I mean, there's sometimes it's actionable, but usually it's not. How do you know you've been discriminated against? You know, very rarely are there clear signs of it. If there were clear signs, I would have done something about it. But no, it was just a feeling.
That was actually another question that was in here. Have any of us felt discriminated against? You know, actually, to be honest with you, piggybacking on, well, I don't know if so. On Mona's point, yeah, see, I grew up here, so. Actually, after becoming Muslim, because I grew up in an American society where we still have white privilege, after becoming Muslim and wearing hijab, I didn't know what that was growing up. I really didn't know what that was. I mean, I heard people talk about it, but I didn't know what it was. After I started wearing the veil, I started to see what that was. Because it was something I'd taken for granted. I didn't really realize what that difference was. And after wearing the veil and being called a few thousand names, you know, I started to understand a similitude of what minorities experience in America. And that was, and I did feel discrimination in a number of arenas, but, you know, it was a blessing at the same time because it made me able to relate to people a lot easier.
I think several times I feel like people automatically assume that you don't speak English sometimes.
I've heard that.
And even sometimes when I'm buying things in the store, one time actually someone accused me of trying to steal something. So, I mean, I think people have this, you know, image that, oh, you know, you're foreign or you don't know what's going on. And So that does happen now and then. But overall, living here in Michigan, I feel like there's so many Muslims that I don't really think twice about wearing hijab, or I don't really feel that people are looking at me or anything. So.
I just wanted to add that I think one thing that at least fear of discrimination has instilled in me is a feeling that I need to be better. Yeah. I've got to be better than my peers, at least, you know, academically, you know, I've got to get, you know, I had to get A's. In my work, I've got to do everything excellently, no mistakes, and I've got to be, you know, the best. I mean, that's something that my parents instilled in me as a child, too, always got to be the best. But I think wearing hijab, if I were to make a mistake, it's going to be blown up much more than if, you know, maybe somebody who didn't would. So it pushes me to be better, and I guess that's okay.
Yeah, I felt that too.
What about after 9/11? Did that have any effect on, you know, I mean, people, did they start thinking of Arabs or, you know, Muslims as being terrorists or whatever? I mean, just wondering.
I think people were more fearful after 9/11. So, you know, there were more maybe suspicious looks, you know. But, you know, just like Mona was saying, it makes you want to be better, you know, do the best. Well, it made me want to be nicer and friendlier to people, you know, bigger smile, more polite, more caring about them, you know, do my best to dispel whatever fear they might have.
In a way, I was going to say, in a way, that was the best thing that kind of happened to our community, because it forces us as Muslims to be out and about, and not to just have our tea and eat our hummus and, you know, be satisfied in our little separate lives that we had for so long. And I think it's so necessary, the interaction that I talked about when I was speaking before. And 9/11 forced us to do that. Right. And it forced me to, you know, put a play out there, so, you know, and talk and to interact, and it's good. But yeah, there is a difference. And even now, you know, every time a news story comes up when some other Muslim somewhere is doing something, there's definitely, I don't know if you all have experienced this, you see when you're driving, people are doing this on the steering wheels when they see a hijab. At least to me, I notice it all the time. Loser! Oh. You know, so it comes up really fast. Not the finger, but the loser thing. I've seen it like 25 times with young guys with caps on, usually with the trucks. And so I'm like, that must be a college kind of thing. But anyway, so there is hostility. But there are also events like this. Many, many events where people want to come and want to interact. And so that's good. It's the good and the bad. But yeah, 9/11 did change stuff for me. But then again, I could hardly tell the difference because I didn't know if I was being discriminated against as a black American. you know, or is it the scarf?
Where was it?
Okay.
On a personal level, I actually felt more of an outpour of sincere love and kindness than I did of any discrimination. There might have been a couple, you know, instances. Well, although I was oblivious to the L sign, I didn't know that meant loser. So maybe I missed a few of those. But I felt like even in the grocery store, people were so nice to me, and you know, the neighbors were so nice, and they would come and ask and see if there was anything that they could do, you know, for us or to watch out for us. And so I actually felt like an outpouring of this kindness from my community.
I noticed an intensity change after 9/11, but I actually, when I became Muslim, I was a teenager still, and it was during the Gulf War. And I noticed even then this sort of feeling. I just noticed the intensity change after 9/11. It was kind of like building. And interestingly, I did a national survey on the hijab, and one of the questions I asked in there was about 9/11. Like, how did this affect your wearing hijab? And overwhelmingly, the response from women was that it made women who because there was this idea in the media that women were just throwing off their veils because they didn't want to be identified as Muslim. But actually, overwhelmingly, women put their veils on that weren't wearing them, and it made them more have a stronger conviction about it. But there was also an interesting difference in among the community itself in terms of ethnicity. So, for example, I got many responses from African American women saying that they didn't feel anything after 9/11 because in the African American community, Muslims have been a part of that community for so long that it was like, these are our brothers and sisters. I mean, like, we see these people all the time. It was, like, no different. They didn't feel that sense of terrorism, but more toward people who looked Arab or like Arab or were Arab. I thought that was an interesting distinction in our broader community. Okay, for the for Shireen and Mona, they want to know, how did you deal with teenage issues growing up?
I got married young.
That's how we deal with it.
I think it was nice that how we had our community outside of school, and it was nice to just have friends of the Muslim faith that we had the same values, and we could just, I felt like whenever there was something that I couldn't do over there, I always had an alternate activity I could do at the mosque, or so I didn't feel left out or that, you know, I couldn't participate in things. I always had an alternate. I think my parents really thought about that, and they wanted us to be surrounded by, you know, good friends and have a support system. So
yeah, and I think my parents and I had a very strong sense of trust with each other, that my parents were okay with us going out late, and, you know, as long as we let them know when we were going to be home. They didn't even have a curfew, but there was this sense of trust between us that they, they knew that I wouldn't do anything that was crazy and that sort of thing. They didn't have that with all my siblings, but they had it with me.
As a teenager growing in public, going to public school, did you struggle with your classmates, what they're doing, senior parties, going out, even going to the mall, certain things, like track, you need to wear certain outfits, certain issues like everyday basis, because in Arab public schools you don't have that good community support, and in private schools like Crescent. So were there an issue for you, or you chose to disengage completely and went to the mosque as a community for your...
Well, yeah, I felt that I was confident in my religion, and I told people what I could do, and so they knew my boundaries. And actually, my track coach was the one who suggested certain clothing for me. He was like, oh, I found this pant that you could wear that will make you, you know, it won't be too heavy, and it's a nice light cloth. And, you know, he would suggest to me what, you know, I could wear. So I didn't feel that I was separate from them at all, because I participated in these things, but I just accommodated. I made my own accommodations. And
Can I speak a little bit on that, too? I had children in high school, in Ypsilanti High School, and they wanted to play soccer and swim and be in theater, and they had to have the hijab, et cetera. And just as, you know, you're saying, we found the teachers very, very accommodating. Like, they would wear the black leggings that people wear under the soccer uniform and the hijab, as long as it matched the school colors. That's what they had to wear. And the theater teacher really, really went over and beyond the call of duty to me, because she picked this play, and when my daughter got the lead, she, the way she costumed it, everybody had to wear a scarf. She picked an era where all of them had little kerchiefs. I was just astounded at, you know, the respect and the love that was given to my children in high school. But of course, they were outgoing. See, now there were problems with other kids who did not interact. So I think the key is knowing people and being part, like you said, being a part of the society. And that made all the difference. Oh, and for prom, their brother, my son, took his sisters to prom. They had a limo, and I sewed long, you know, they had the prom dresses, but they had the hijab over with long sleeve jackets and all that. So we get around. We do it.
Okay, our next question is, today I watched Dr. Phil on NBC, I think that is, about racial issues labeling Muslim kids terrorists. Do you have any idea how to educate the community on this? I guess.
Well, I think it goes back to what Baina and Mona and Shireen were both really saying about, you know, getting involved and interacting and not being isolated. You know, our neighbors are kind to us because they know us. You know, they know we're not those people that they see on the news, right? You know, a stranger is somebody you don't know, right? If you are involved, interacting in the community, then people really won't, you know, accuse you, okay? Children, yes, children are mean. They do tease each other. And, you know, educators in any school should treat that type of harassment, it's bullying, you know, and it needs to be treated as bullying, whether you're calling somebody a terrorist or whether you're calling them ugly and fat, you know. Because when it comes from children like that, it's really more a case of bullying and harassment and, you know, trying to upset another child. And that's how it should be treated by teachers, you know. Anything else?
No, I think education of the community means that we need to have some kind of program set up that we go into schools for outreach. And I think that, and I was thinking about even writing a manual for public schools for how to deal with things, issues, dress, hijab, Ramadan, the fasting, not eating marshmallows at parties, etc. Some kind of guide, you know, that we have, and then having people come in to like PTA meetings, but those days where they have teacher services. So it teach the teachers, the principals, and then the teachers can teach the children. You know,
CARE does that, Council on American Islamic Relations. There's a Michigan chapter, and they do have, if anyone's interested in getting a speaker to come to your organization, they do have people that do that.
Okay. Have any of you studied or noticed any parallels between the Muslim American experience and that of other minority faith groups, such as Catholics, including Irish, Italian, and Latino communities, Jews, Mormons, etc.?
Yeah, these are really good questions. I think there's a pattern. I know that when I was growing up, my father used to talk about how each immigrant community was discriminated against, you know, in its turn, you know, when they came and certain amount of years after that. So I think there's a pattern to that whole thing, you know, so some discrimination that people face is because they're the new guys on the block, you know. And it's a question of them interacting in society and their neighbors getting to know them as individuals instead of those people over there, you know. So in that sense, yeah, I think there's a general pattern with each immigrant group being viewed as outsiders, being viewed with suspicion until people get to know them and they acclimate themselves to the society as well.
You know, there is one interesting difference, though, I think, in the American Muslim landscape, which is that we can trace Muslims back to, there were Muslim slaves, you know, there were even Muslims before that. They weren't really, you know, like we're thinking of the immigrant story, that's not really the same story. As well, there was a difference in like the Irish Americans when they came, and there was a lot of poverty and so forth. The wave of immigrants that we Muslim immigrants that we had come to this country, most a lot of them came as professionals. was a whole different experience. So, I mean, there are some parallels, but there are also some differences, I think, that have made it maybe in some ways a little more difficult, but in other ways easier. I mean, certainly within the indigenous American community. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I agree, but another challenge with us is that we're all different. Mm-hmm. We represent like 80, what was the number? Something like 83 different ethnicities in America or something that call themselves Muslims. So we don't agree all the time. So we're not a united force to stand against anything that comes either, because we're splintered.
We're still working that out.
that's a challenge for us as a community. So,
is there a verse in the Quran that instructs Muslim women to cover their heads? If so, what is it, and which surah? Oh, do you mind if I address this one? Okay. Actually, in the Quran, this is a common mistake made in the popular media that it is not prescribed for women to cover because it doesn't actually say the word hijab. There are other words, though, that are referenced in the Quran that in Islamic understanding, we have it's called fiqh. We have what's called fiqh al-lugha, which is the understanding of language, right? So in the time of the Prophet Muhammad, ﷺ, the Arabs of that time knew a certain Arabic, just like we have, you know, our colloquial language of today, and the kids have their sayings like, I don't know, laugh out loud and whatever. The Arabs of that time, of the Prophet's time, knew when the revelation came about dressing modestly exactly what he meant. So he didn't have to say, it must be a veil, and you must wear it this way, and you know, because the Arabs knew what that meant at that time. Over time, though, you know just how our own language has changed over time, and other words have taken on new meanings and so forth. This has also happened in Arabic, which is why we have this canon of understanding, this canon of fiqh called fiqh al-lugha. So those who actually have studied this know that the people of that time knew what that meant, so there was no need to explicitly say that. Now that people have gotten further away from this study, and you have people coming into Islam who maybe don't even know Arabic, it's harder for them to understand that without knowing this history and this background. And one of the things that is really beautiful about Islam is that we do have this tradition, this strong tradition of history and understanding and keeping track of that so that we can get to the real understanding of things. So for those who have been running around saying that it's not required, I just assume that they just haven't gotten that far in their study yet to really know that it is. So I don't know if that really
Anybody know the specific
surah
that says cover
your...
It's tablas.
My son-in-law should know.
Do
you
think that... Ahmed,
what's the verse? Do you know? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think, too, that the way that they lived during the time of the Prophet, you know, that is called the sunnah, which is the way of the life of the Prophet, which is a supplement to how our understanding of the Quran is, and an example of that is the way that we pray. You won't find in the Quran where it says exactly, you know, the five prayers and how they're performed, but we know to do that based on the teachings of the Prophet. So in addition to the language being a barrier in the Quran for when it tells us how to dress, we have the supplementation of how the women, the believers, the Muslims at that time, how they dressed. And although it's changed over time, and you'll see women, you know, some women are cover fully and I wear pants, you know, it's just, it's different, but we know that the veiling of the hair and of the bosom and just the general rules of modesty also as a supplement from the sunnah.
Which was another question that we had, actually, that we all wear hijab differently up here. So was that cultural or religious? And for many, it's culturally determined.
And what you were saying right now did recall to my mind that, you know, there are, of course, variable translations of the Arabic, but one that I'm very familiar with, you know, and I cannot quote the exact chapter and verse, but it says, and draw your head coverings over your bosoms, you know. People did have something on their head. It was their chest that maybe was uncovered. Okay, so, I mean, there was already a veil, so it didn't specifically need to say veil yourself, but, you know, take what you have as a cover and cover what needs to be covered, you know. Another verse talks about women's adornments, you know, and there have been various interpretations in fiqh of what that means, what should be covered. Well, everything that's attractive, you know, and so many scientific studies have dealt with the attractiveness, right, of the form of the woman. So then what should be covered? You know, everything that's attractive. So there will be different interpretations, but yes, there are specific verses.
Yeah. And we really should have. You know, that's wrong of us not to have that. So, yeah.
In fact, I'm going to apologize that none of us know exactly the name and chapter of the verse, because we should.
The words, though, in the Quran that refer to this are like jilbab.
Right,
and
right.
Tublis, right? Am I saying that right? Mona?
I don't know.
But as far as the differences in our styles, and it's just like anything else.
Culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think people just, you know, according to fashion or whatever, you yeah. can accommodate as, you know, as you want to. And one of my friends has a company or a blog. She started Hijab Trends, and she just finds different, you know, clothing that you can find anywhere and shows you ways that you can accommodate it for, like, people that wear hijabs. So it's part of being American Muslim, I guess.
Yeah, definitely part of being an American, I think it's
interesting. Definitely part of being an American Muslim, because, you know, we're not bound by any particular cultural tradition. So that's a nice freedom for us, yeah.
We have only a few more minutes for questions, so if I don't get to everybody's question, please forgive me, but you can approach us, you know, afterwards. To all the speakers, what do you think are the most important initiatives we should focus on to build bridges of understanding? What is most needed?
Interaction. In various ways. I mean, even if it's in the grocery store, at the on the lines, you know, officially, formally, and informally, all the time. And thank you for coming.
Yeah, a lot of times people say, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude, but I wanted to ask, but please ask, we're happy to answer questions. I think you shouldn't be shy to ask. Most people would love to, you know, explain or talk to you about it.
Okay, did you want to say anything else?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say the only thing that dispels stereotypes is getting to know people as individuals. So that's interaction and communication.
Sister Mona, being married as a young and as a professional Muslim woman, could you talk about work-life balance?
I can talk about it. I haven't figured it out yet. It's tough. I had my first child at age 21. I had just finished undergrad 4 days before she was born. And it blew me away. I mean, taking care of a child is consuming. You know, it meant time consuming, physically consuming, mentally consuming. And if you I had ambitions and I really wanted to, you know, get my professional life on track too, and I went to law school at U of M, and I went full time. For me, what worked was taking advantage of the extended family that was around me, and they helped me raise my children. And every day it's a struggle, and I'm still working on it. And, you know, it's one of those things where if you really feel horrible every day, and you feel like you're not. You know, there were times in my career. There was a time when I was working in Lansing, and I drove back and forth every day. And you know, even though I liked what I was doing there and it was fulfilling, I would get home at a time where I see my kids for like an hour and put them to sleep, and I'm gone in the morning before they wake up, and that wasn't fulfilling to me. So I switched. And right now I think I have an okay balance. I'm my own boss, so that kind of helps. So my work is more flexible. Sometimes I'm up late at night finishing things, but I get to see my kids in the morning, and I try to not come home not too late. But it's an ongoing struggle. I don't think I'll ever really get it 100%, but it's something that I continue to strive towards.
We actually had an audience member provide us with the answer to that question about where does it talk about hijab in the Quran. It's Surah Nur, chapter 24, verse 31, is where it starts. Yes, the 24th chapter, which is Surah Nur, and verse 31.
I think he looked it up on his iPhone. There's an app for that.
Oh, is that hard?
Thank you.
One quick question. Wonderful. What about interfaith marriages or your children growing up, not Muslim?
We do have interfaith marriages. And Islam men are allowed to marry Christian women and Jewish women, people of the book. That's what
But what's the attitude towards that? Are they frowned upon, or are they?
I don't think we could say it's monolithic in terms of the attitude. It varies, depending on where, you know, which family it's, what background.
I do have a Christian sister-in-law. My brother is married to a Christian woman, and we love her, and she's awesome. You know, my parents love her. We love her family. It worked out well, but I know that's not the case for everyone. And I would hope that my kids marry Muslim, but there's hopes and there's reality.
Does it bother you that women cannot be imams or leaders of the mosque? Cannot be leaders of the mosque, imams, the minister of the...
No. There's always this thing, I think, in American society that women can't do what men do. But I never wanted to. I was really happy to be a mother. I felt that being a woman is the most blessed thing to be. I get to shape the future of society through motherhood, through teaching my children. And I never wanted to be, go out, you know. I mean, that was all around me. Like I said, Betty Friedan, you know, and the whole feminist movement was definitely out there when I was in school in New York. But I never felt that. I don't feel... I don't think we as Muslims feel that we need to be equal to men in a way. We are equal to men in the sight of God. Doesn't mean we have to do the same job. Not being able to do the same job doesn't make you equal. I mean, so is the are two nurses equal? Even though they're doing the same nursing job? No. Just because you can't be an imam doesn't mean you aren't an imam. I don't know.
But outside of the imams, I do feel that our communities, our mosques, do need more influence from women in their leadership and in the way that they're run. And I think that's something that we're kind of working towards. But it's been a little too slow. But I.
We do. I mean, women do serve on various boards. I don't know if they serve any of the mosque boards, but. And different community groups, they serve on boards. And I do think there is some preference, you know, culturally. So, for example, like in China, the Muslims in China, some of the women have their own mosque where they go and pray together, just women. So there are instances where you see, but they're still not imams, but they have their own separate space.
I just want to add to that real quick. I also think that it's not just the leadership is also not there. What like Mona was saying, it has a lot to do with cultural barriers. I think one thing that people do need to understand is a lot of us are first generation, whereas the American community has settled in for many, many, many years and many, many generations. We are just beginning, and we are finding our way. a lot of us are first generation. So just because women are not necessarily imams does not mean that we don't have a strong influence already in the mosque, in our homes, in our families. Education is extremely, extremely stressed upon for women in Islam. And as a matter of fact, the Prophet's wives, and especially his youngest wife, or his last wife, Aisha, she was the pretty much fountain of knowledge after his death. And knowledge is stressed upon very, very highly for women. So even though we may not be out in the forefront, does not necessarily mean that we are not a strong influence, and a lot of the barriers are cultural more than they are religion. So I just wanted to stress that.
Okay, I think actually we have some very large questions up here, very interesting questions about human rights, about, inferiority issues, conflicts between Sunnis and Shias, and questions about the Middle East and France. And maybe we ran out of time, though. So maybe we can provide some answers to this, Grace, for the ICPJ website or something. But I would like to ask you at this time, I would like to thank everybody for coming out on a Thursday night, and I'd like to ask you to be sure to fill out the evaluations on your chairs. I think you have two of them. One of them. Okay. And if anybody didn't get one by chance, we have extras. Just let us know if you need one. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.